of thing which goes on in high energy physics experiments all the time, and it's one of the principal ways in which you get information about the nature of elementary particles, or indeed the nature of other things like solids or, well, virtually any kind of physical system. And therefore, it's something that we have to study in a certain amount of detail and figure out methods for coping with calculating scattering amplitudes from fundamental pictures of what's going on. What I've always found difficult about scattering is a description of what the scattering cross-section is. That's, after all, what experimentalists measure. So you measure cross-sections. So what precisely do you mean by a cross-section? So let's look at a very simple situation where we have just some blob of stuff here. It could be a nucleus or an atom or even some macroscopic object. And I'm going to, at least initially, probably for everything that I'm going to do here, assume that this can be described by some spherically symmetric potential. V of R, such that V of R goes to zero as R goes to infinity. That means that if you are a long way away from this object, you can regard whatever you're scattering as essentially free particles. So let's set up a system of coordinates. R equals zero, the origin of this thing will be the middle of this blob. And typically what you do is you say, I'm going to fire in particles from somewhere over here and make them scatter off this thing. So we need to give this axis here some kind of label, we'll call it the z-axis, so that the particles come in from z equals minus infinity. So what will happen to a classical particle under these circumstances? Well, of course, it will be scattered by this potential. And so what will happen is that if you have something coming in here, classically it will follow some trajectory. Perhaps it looks something like that. This angle here is usually called the scattering angle, and I will call this thing theta s. Now, for this system, spherical symmetry means that, since this thing is spherically symmetric, if you consider rotations about this axis, the entire system remains invariant. So spherical symmetry of this scattering problem implies that you are axisymmetric, namely, the problem that you're considering is symmetric about the z-axis. So that if you invented some azimuthal angle around here, phi, then whatever you are doing will be independent of phi. In fact, you can relate everything you see here to conventional polar coordinates. You see this angle theta is basically the polar coordinate from the z-axis. So if you think about this, x would be r sine theta cos phi, y equals r sine theta sine phi, and z is r cos theta. Then what I have drawn here is effectively the xz plane. I can try and make this picture a bit more three-dimensional, if you like. So you could imagine a whole collection of particles. So for example, a particle down here will scatter into the mirror image of this, and the whole thing, you like, will span out a circle that looks like that. Now, if you make, well, one way of parameterizing where this particular particle trajectory is to say that there is a distance b from the axis to this where this particle is, and B you're going to call the impact parameter. Now, of course, you could change the impact parameter by a little bit, and if you do that, you'll change the scattering angle by a little bit, so that a neighboring particle trajectory would look something like this. So if you were out here, then it might get scattered that way. It might get scattered less, of course, in which case my picture would have to be the other way around. So this would be b plus, so this would be db. This would be, have a scattering angle which is a little bit different. So this would be scattered through theta s plus d theta s. And what you see is, of course, that you get a little annulus here that looks something like that. And that annulus would have area 2 pi b db. Now, what's happened to the scattering? Under this change of B, you've changed the scattering angle from theta S to theta plus DS. So out here, you'll also have a sort of area. So this will also scan out a bit of a sphere. And if you think about this, what will happen is that as you go from theta s to theta s plus ds, you will scan out near infinity a solid angle usually called d omega, which is equal to sine theta s d theta s d phi. Or if you prefer it, you can integrate over the entirety of the two sphere, sorry, the entirety of the circle, and call this 2 pi times sine theta s ds. That's because this thing is independent of phi. So that is the idea of scattering. And so if you think about what's going on, this thing here presents a cross-section this is what you mean by the cross section, d sigma. It's defined to be this area, 2 pi b db. It's related to the amount of solid angle that is spread out here, which is sine theta s d phi. The ratio of these two things is called the scattering cross-section, or the differential scattering cross-section. D sigma d omega is equal to 2 pi b db over sine theta s d theta s d phi. The dependence on phi is completely trivial in this case because it is axisymmetric. If you're interested in the total cross section, that will be the integral of the differential cross-section over all solid angles. So sigma is d sigma d omega integrated over the sphere at infinity. This is over all solid angles, meaning theta s goes from 0 to pi, phi goes from 0 to 2 pi. So that corresponds to integrating over all solid angles as you go round in this direction, and all possible scattering angles which go from 0 all the way round to pi. So that's how you calculate a scattering cross-section in terms of the trajectories of particles. That's traditionally what you mean. Now, of course, in practice, that isn't actually what you do. You fire a whole beam of particles. And so a way in which you can think of this is you can ask about the flux of particles through this little annulus here. Flux, remember, is the number of particles crossing that surface per unit area, per unit time. What you measure out near infinity from the scatter process will be the flux up here in that sort of region between theta s and theta s plus d theta s. So the flux d sigma d omega is equal to, another way of writing it would be the flux, because after all the number of particles is conserved, the flux through d omega of scattered particles divided by the flux of incoming particles. That's because particles are conserved. So that's another way of describing what the scattering cross-section is. Yes?
Actual cross-section, should we integrate out the phi of the denominator? Because in the numerator, it was integrated over.
Well, you could do if you wanted to do. Depends what you want to consider. But usually, you think of it as being precisely like this.
you could just say, well, the effect of the d-phi is just integrated over 2 pi, but we have to decide whether we're going to integrate or not. Usually we do not.
On the numerator, it has already been integrated.
Yes. Well, if you want to consider scattering into the system, you can also just replace that by 2 pi, which case you're thinking of this quantity. You want to call this d-phi as well.
Now, I think it's actually worth doing a classical problem in scattering before doing a quantum mechanical version of the same problem. So let's actually look at a specific scattering problem. So I wanted to think of one that you can actually do that's relatively easy. So I wanted to think of one that you can do both classically and quantum mechanically. So an example would be to put V of R equal to K over R squared. I want K to be positive, so that this is a repulsive potential. Then classically, the particles will describe orbits something like this. So what you have to do to find the cross-section is to find the orbit. The easiest way of doing this is to solve the problem in spherical coordinates, r theta phi, and the easiest way to do this is to write down the Lagrangian and figure out the equations of motion from it. Because V of R is spherically symmetric, the whole system is going to be axisymmetric, so we can just simply restrict ourselves to this particular plane. And if you ask, what is the Lagrangian? Well, there'll be the kinetic energy term, which is a half m into r dot squared plus r squared theta dot squared, r being the distance from the origin to some particular point, and theta being this angle. So that's the kinetic energy. Then there's the potential energy, minus v, will be a minus k over r squared. I hope that everyone knows about Lagrangians. So that's the Lagrangian for this particular system, and now what you need to do is to calculate the equations of motion. Yes. Sorry?
While you were raising a quick question, why do we integrate over the solid angle rather than like integrating over the cross section and seeing what solid angle we get out? It's mathematical sense
to do it that way, but it just, what it seems like what you're trying, that you know the size of the beam you're firing and want to predict how big a beam will resolve.
Well, you want to know, really, if a particle comes in here, by how much does it get scattered? So you will have some detector over here, which you can move around, but what you're actually doing is you're asking, where is this detector relative to the scattering spectrum? So you really want to work it out based on the position, And what you measure is, of course, a detector that has some finite area.
But you're going to measure, if you're measuring flux, remember that things spread out in space, so what you actually measure is a solid angle, because you have some area that's sitting up there, r squared d omega, where r is the large distance, and that's what you've got. So it comes about really from tradition rather than anything else. So it's what you actually do in practice. So here is our particle orbit. So what we really said is that at some time t, that angle is theta, and it's a distance r from the scattering center. That means that you know already that you've got something that looks like this. At r equals infinity, the particle is coming in from the extreme left, so the incoming particle has theta equal to pi. R will then decrease down to some minimum and then increase again. The outgoing particle has theta equal to whatever the scattering angle is, because that corresponds to going out in this direction. So that's what we really need to do. We need to find not so much R and theta as functions of t. You want to find an equation for the shape of the orbit, r as a function of theta. Well, so you write down the Euler-Lagrange equations coming from this Lagrangian and see what you get. The first thing that you notice is that theta is an ignorable coordinate, because the Lagrangian does not depend on theta, only on theta dot, and therefore r squared theta dot is equal to a constant. Or if you prefer it, m r squared theta dot is equal to a constant. In other words, the angular momentum about this point is conserved, following from the fact that v of r is spherically symmetric. I'm going to get rid of that m. I want to leave it like that. What is the value of this constant? Let's suppose that the particles that are coming in have velocity v. Impact parameter b. Then essentially r squared theta dot is the moment of the velocity out here, so this thing is equal to vb. If you are confused by that, think about angular momentum. What is the angular momentum of this particle about this point? It's the moment of momentum. The momentum is mv. It's at a distance b from the axis out at infinity. So its angular momentum is mvb. Taking out the m's, r squared theta dot is equal to vb, v being the velocity of the particles, and b being the impact parameter. So that means wherever you see theta dot, you can replace it by, well, let's call this thing energy E. Typically, things are specified in terms of energy rather than in terms of velocity, because energy is something that you measure for your the objects that you are scattering. And so everywhere you see theta dot, you can write 2e over m, the 1/2, times b over r squared. That's right. That's v, that's b, and that's r squared, so that's right. What about the r equation of motion? Well, there are two ways in which you could do this. You could just simply say that I'm going to calculate by brute force what the r equation of motion is. Or alternatively, you could say that energy is conserved. And either way, you will get the same answer. Which way do you want me to do it? Some question at the back.
Is v times v? This v is not constant.
It's only out near infinity. It is the velocity with which the particles are entering the system. So it is only out at infinity. The point is that since energy is conserved, here you start thinking of potential, and so the velocity will change. However, no one answered my question. Do we want to do it by conservation of energy, or do we want to do it by brute force?
Conservation of energy.
That's fine.
All right, that seems to be the loudest answer. So, the total energy is equal to 1/2 m r solid squared plus 1/2 m r squared theta dot squared. Theta dot squared is 2e over m. b over r to the fourth plus a over r squared is equal to a constant. What is that constant? Will you evaluate it by looking at what happens at infinity? This term will go off like 1 over r squared, this term will go off like 1 over r squared. And this term is equal to 1/2 mv squared, or equal to the total energy of the thing, so we can call that E. So this is equal to E. So we have the equation for r dot. So r dot squared, let's just add up all the rubbish here, r dot squared is equal to. So we want to multiply by 2 over m, and get this on the other side. So we get 2 e over m. So that's that term. Then this term looks like 1 over r squared, and this term also looks like 1 over r squared. So there's a minus 1 over r squared. From here, you get 2 k over m. And from this term, we get 2EB
over M. That's right. Anyone want to disagree? B should be B squared. Absolutely. I knew something looked a bit funny. So I would like to write this as 2e over m into 1 minus alpha over r squared. To make my life easier. So alpha is this funny expression here. Is it alpha or alpha squared? Actually, none of those things. I want to call this alpha squared b squared over r squared. So that alpha squared will be the combination 1 plus k over e b squared. So alpha is that. Do we all agree? I think that's right. So the alpha equals 1 limit corresponds to no scattering because you put k equal to 0. So now you can see that what I said before was true, that R dot starts out as being negative. The particle trajectory turns round at some point where this is equal to 0 in the brackets. From when, after which R dot is positive. Now, what we want to do is to find, as I said, R as a function of theta. We do not want R as a function of t and theta as a function of t. So the simple thing to do is to derive a differential equation for it. Actually, it occurs to me that since Rob was doing the Schwarzschild metric, did he do orbits in Schwarzschild? So this is the same kind of calculation. You look for dr d theta, which is equal to r dot over theta dot, which is equal to the square root of this mess. So there's the root 2e over m. And then there's going to be a 1 minus alpha squared b squared over r squared to the 1/2. And then you have to divide by theta dot, which stupidly I erased. Theta dot
root of 2e over m.
2e over m.
E over r.
Let's bring it back. Theta dot is square root of 2e over m b over r squared. So, divide by theta dot. Root m over 2e, r squared over b. So these horrible things cancel out. And you're left with that expression. Make sure that I've done that right. R d theta is R over B into that thing. Let me multiply by, I want to take one of these factors of R into this square root to make life nice. So it's R over B into R squared minus alpha squared B squared to the 1/2. So that's dr d theta. Now you have to do a horrible integral to figure out the orbit. So let's see. The integral that you have to do is, at least it's separable, so that's good. You've got a dr divided by r into r squared minus alpha squared b squared to the 1/2 is equal to the integral of theta. And I think there's a b somewhere. Right. So there's a b up there. You see that's got to be right because this is dimensionless. And this is dimensionless. B's got dimensions of length. So we have to do that integral. Does anybody know how to do it?
Substitute.
the sine theta.
Yeah,
sort of
that's the obvious thing to do. It doesn't work.
Oh, it doesn't work.
And change the bar into 1 over u.
Uh-huh.
1 over u.
1 over u.
So that dr of the
bar. Oh, yes, that will work. And then you can use a trigonometric substitution. Actually, you can use a trigonometric substitution right from the outset if you are imaginative.
That's currently squared over sine squared.
Right. Alpha e my time.
So that's the obvious substitution, well, not the obvious substitution to make, but a substitution you can make. It is absolutely right that it is often useful to make this substitution to get something nice, but we can do it all at once. Dr is equal to alpha beta over sine squared chi times cos chi. I'm not going to worry about sines in the square root at the moment. We'll just fix that all up later. So this is the integral of b, let's see, alpha b cos chi d chi over sine squared chi. We need a d chi there. I suppose there's a minus sign here, but I'm not going to worry about that. Then there's an r, alpha beta over sine chi. Here, there's an r squared minus, so you get here a 1 over sine squared chi minus 1 to the 1 half. So, that cancels that. 1 over sine squared is really the same thing as 1 minus sine squared chi over chi. So this sine squared will cancel the other one. This is a cos squared chi, which cancels that. And so you're left with B. I can't help feeling that I'm missing an alpha somewhere. Let me just check. Do you say it's alpha squared? No. I can't even understand my own notes at this point. Yes, because there was one factor from here and one factor from here. Good. That looks much better. So now we've done this integral, it reads chi over alpha equals theta plus a constant. That's an equation for the orbit. It is perhaps something that we should play around with a little bit to get a nice answer before we do anything else. From here, you know that r alpha b over r is equal to sine chi. So what this tells you is that chi is the inverse sine of alpha b over r. And that is the same thing as alpha theta plus a constant. So now we have to think about what this constant actually is. It looks horrible, but it's not that horrible. As r goes to infinity, you want to start off at theta is equal to pi. The inverse sine of, well, if this is infinity, this thing is zero, is equal to. Well, you have to decide what it's going to be equal to, but probably you're going to say that it's equal to 0 followed by pi. So I would like to start it off at 0. So I'm going to get that at r equals infinity, theta is equal to pi, so this constant is equal to minus alpha pi. So you get inverse sine of alpha b over r is equal to alpha into theta minus pi. That's an equation for the shape of the orbit. What then is the scattering angle? Well, it's when this thing is next equal to zero, so it's at pi. So pi is equal to alpha into scattering angle minus pi. So there's a formula for the scattering angle. Theta S is equal to pi into 1 minus 1 over alpha. And remember that alpha was given in terms of various physical things. It was 1 plus k over e b squared to the 1 half. So that is a formula that relates the scattering angle to the impact parameter. So from this, we can actually calculate the scattering cross section. D sigma, d omega, is going to be equal to 2 pi b db divided by, because of axis symmetry, sine theta scattering d theta scattering, and then d phi or 2 pi, depending on your taste, but I'm going to put in a 2 pi here, because it's really axis symmetric, which I think deals with whoever question it was about the factors of 2 pi. So this is 1 over sine theta s d of b squared by d theta s and a half. So that's the easy way of calculating it, because this formula gives you a way of calculating b as a function of theta. Let's actually do that. So we want to find b as a function of theta from these things. So you can do some horrible algebra, well, not too horrible, and I got b squared is pi minus theta s, all squared, divided by 2 pi theta s minus theta s all squared times k over e. So that's my formula for b squared as a function of theta. Now we can just substitute into here. All we've got to do is to differentiate. D of b squared by d theta s. I take it everyone is happy to be calling b db a half of db squared. Somehow it's never so obvious that you should do that. So there's a k over e which comes out of the whole thing. A 2 pi theta s minus theta s squared, all squared. And then there will be some mess up here, which I guess you will allow me to work out and just write down. Minus 2 pi squared into pi minus theta s. I think that you want to just get rid of this minus sign, because I said I wasn't very careful about signs, and I haven't been. Cross sections have got to be positive. So you get rid of this. obvious the cross sections have got to be positive, and I wasn't careful anyway. So, what is a scattering cross section? D sigma d omega is equal to an overall factor of K over E, and then some mass pi squared into pi minus theta s over 2 pi theta s minus theta s squared, all squared, and a 1 over sine theta s. There are some things to notice about this. The very first thing that you will notice is that it decreases as energy goes up. So it's a decreasing function of E. This really ought to be a universal feature of scattering cross sections, because it's saying if you crank up the energy with which you fire the thing in, the more likely it is that you will just, this potential will become completely and utterly insignificant, and so the thing will just fly past, doing nothing. So the fact that cross sections die off as a function of energy is good and to be expected. There is something else which is kind of important if you stare at this formula, and that is that if you put theta s equal to pi, you get zero. You should not feel surprised by that either. It says that if you shoot a particle at some scattering center, classically, it doesn't come back at you. Not much gets completely reflected. Another thing you might do is to say, well, what's the total scattering cross-section? This is the integral of d sigma d omega over all solid angles. So it's going to be the integral of this thing since we've already taken the factor of 2 pi out, we don't care about that. From 0 to pi. So this nasty term cancels out, leaving you with an integral that you can do. And so there's a pi squared, and then let's say 1 over 2 pi theta s minus theta s squared with a factor of 1. If I differentiate this, I get 2 pi outside the whole thing. So I have to get a 1 over 2 pi. And then I get a theta s over pi, just a half. And a minus sign. So you end up with that. This diverges. You should not feel surprised by that either. What it's saying is the divergence is coming from small scattering angle, because you've got a theta s here, so for small theta s this term dominates and gives you infinity. That's really a reflection of the fact that you have long-range potentials. This often happens with long-range potentials. Remember that 1 over r squared is a power of infinity, not an exponential. So it does correspond to a long-range potential. Don't worry about it. Of course, if you wanted to work out the scattering between some finite angle, you can do that because this integrand is quite well behaved. So finite angles is okay. Yes. Shouldn't it always happen?
Doesn't always happen, no.
Right. So I thought my understanding
is examples.
Okay. Then what's so my understanding, which is clearly wrong, is that the cross section, if like omega is some region of the sphere, the cross section of omega is the area of like the incoming beam that gets scattered into omega. Is that not
right? That's basically sort of correct, yes.
So,
but it does not have to be, the total cross-section does not have to be infinite. In this classical case, I think it probably often is.
So then, in the classical case, if you ask yourself, you know, how much of the beam, like let omega be the entire sphere, right. And you say, how much of the beam is scattered into somewhere in the sphere? The answer is all of the beam, obviously, right?
Well, more necessarily, it might be absorbed by something.
Maybe what?
It absorbed. So, one of the things that Rob Myers probably calculated is the scattering, is the absorption cross section of black hole and scattering cross section.
I think that's today or tomorrow.
All right, so that will be a counter example. We'll look at some other counter examples.
I think what you're trying to say is that the that you,
so
you're never going to have a particle that doesn't interact at all.
Like he said, if you think of a scattering process as something that takes in incoming particles and spits out outgoing particles, then you know it's a nice map.
It goes in and what come out, which
right.
If you think about the relationship between fluxes.
Right. Okay.
So that's how you do scattering problems. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Doesn't a classical large sphere have a finite cross section?
Yes. That does not have a long range potential.
How can that be?
Right.
If things go in, they have to.
Well, here is an example. Here's a classical hard sphere.
Are you just ignoring the particles that don't hit the sphere?
Right. So that one will do something like that.
Yeah.
Then if it's outside, then nothing happens.
No, if it's outside, it should just contribute to the cross section right at the angle zero, right? So it goes to scattering angle zero.
Wouldn't you say the scattering of this was just pi a square?
What?
Wouldn't you say the scattering cross section of this is just pi a square?
I mean, I suppose you can define it that way. Okay, sure.
Now, what happens if you do this kind of problem? The kind of picture that you've got is still the same kind of thing, but we have to talk about waves rather than trajectories of particles. So what is the wave function of the incoming thing?
No, that would make sense.
So here is a scattering center. Again, it will be described by some potential V of R. Again, the geometrical setup is the same kind of thing, but you have waves coming in here, an incoming wave function, which I will take to be e to the ikz. So that if you act with a momentum operator on this, you will discover the momentum of the incoming waves is equal to h bar k. So the energy, what one often parameterizes this with, is h bar squared k squared over 2m. To parameterize the waves in terms of the wave number as opposed to the momentum is a kind of convenience and will make your life easier. What about the scattered waves? What is their wave function? Well, the wave function is going to be an outgoing spherical wave somewhere out here. With a strength which depends on the angle, theta. What is the form of this wave? Yes.
So when you're scattering on this, there's a plane wave coming in. Is it, how correct is this? Like, should you really be doing wave packets or something? If
it sounds like a terrible mess.
Yeah, no, I know, but like, this is the way it's always done.
You don't need to do it like that, of course. What you have to do is to evaluate
the probability flux of particles. That's the analog of the classical thing where you have one particle going in, being scattered by a particular amount. You just imagine doing that zillions of times. So you're going to relate this to the flux, which is why I wanted to give the formula for the cross-section in terms of the flux as well as geometrically. So you don't really need wave packets. I guess if you wanted to scatter one particle or something, then you might need to do that, but it can always be decomposed into plane waves. Because whatever wave packet you have, you could write as its Fourier decomposition. And if it's all going in the positive z direction, that's all there is to it. Some superposition of things like that. Yes?
Scattering is wavelength dependent, and you'll need, then you can't use these rocks directly for
meaning that this V will depend on the energy of the particles.
Right.
Going to try harder than what I meant to do.
Oh, not the V, just like the scatter, like
the answer.
What I'm thinking is, right. Like what I'm thinking is
potential scattering. Or
what?
Something which can't be described by potential scattering.
Oh, can that not be described by? Okay, I mean,
I think that's what you mean.
I just mean anything where, like, a long wavelength photon is scattered differently than a short wavelength photon. Because then if you have, like, a photon pulse...
Oh, I see. Well, the energy of the incoming thing is not the same as the energy of the outgoing thing. Here, I have potential scattering. That means the energy of the incoming stuff is the same as the energy of the outgoing stuff.
Okay. Hey.
What you're asking me to do is to calculate what happens if I fire something in and say this thing absorbs some energy by changing its quantum state, for example, and having the outgoing particle having a different energy. Is that what you mean?
I don't think so. But
so, for example, I fire a photon at a hydrogen atom, and instead of doing the hydrogen atom change its state, then the scattered photon will have a different frequency to the unscattered photon.
So it's impossible for scattering to have, like, it's impossible to have dispersion unless there's some sort of energy absorption.
Yeah, because the problem there is I've got to cut the quantum states on the thing is scattering off, which is a harder problem than this one. Not impossible, but just harder.
So, like, if you were to do this with wave packets, like, I guess, like, so you can work this out for the plane waves, and then you can write the wave packets, like, as a Fourier thing. But so, I guess, like, if the scattering process doesn't give you, like, a linear response, like, probably the wave packet coming in gets all messed up as it gets scattered and it'll skip when it comes out. Is that right?
You mean, is the scattering dependent on value of K?
Yes. Yeah, okay, I think this is kind of what I'm
going to
do.
Right.
Oh, no.
That's what I'm
going to do. No.
Because if...
Actually, you can't. We will discover what it is you're listing, if you want some positions of things like that,
okay.
It's calculated.
So if you do have a wave packet like you wanted, you'll have to do some integral over all the k?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a convolution, isn't it?
Yeah.
You just convolve it with the shape of your wave packet.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Right. Scattered wave.
So, what is the form of the scattered wave? Is it obvious that that is the form of the scattered wave out near infinity? This might or might not be obvious. Yeah, it is just what you get for a free particle, but if it's not obvious, you might be worried about the f of theta, you see.
There's got to be a normalization constraint
on
f, right?
Wait a minute.
Oh, that's an f. Is there what I mean is it can't just say, oh, I'll take all the particles and send them straight and send them up and send them.
All of the normalization is encoded in the value of f, which is what we've got to calculate.
Right. It's got to be well normalized. So.
Right.
There must be a plane wave term as well, I guess.
It's already there. So it wouldn't be scattered. You would say the outgoing wave function.
Okay.
So the bit which is not scattered, plus the bit is scattered. And you might want to worry about the normalization of that. True, but it's not, this isn't the scattered bit. Question is, do you believe that this satisfies the Schrodinger equation for all x as r goes to infinity?
Now, for that way, it's approximately free.
Yeah. You'll discover that the things in all that theta are higher order in one over R than just from there. Something into the Schrodinger equation includes it really does work. So that's the form of the wave function. We now want to figure out what the scattering amplitude is, or the cross section. The way to do this is to think about the probability size. The probability class vector
is equal to h bar over 2im into psi star grad psi minus grad of psi star times psi, and represents the flux of particles per unit area per unit time. Let's calculate the probability flux for the incoming particles. Grad psi is just going to give me an ik e to the ikz. Multiply it by psi star, so this thing will give me an ik. from the first term, minus its complex conjugate. So this thing is equal to h bar k over m in the positive z direction. So the flux from this wave is h bar k over m. What about the scattered wave? You're not interested in all components of the flux vector. You're only interested in the flux that is going radially outwards. So you're interested in the flux through some particular bit of the sphere at infinity, which, remember, has got surface area element r squared d omega for a little area that looks like this. The normal is in the radial direction. So you're really only interested in the normal component of that vector, the probability flux vector, to the surface at infinity. So it's the radial component. And because if you want to calculate the number of particles passing through this thing, since there's an r squared here, as r goes to infinity, you're only interested in the 1 over r squared piece of it. That is, fortunately, extremely easy to calculate.
Which is J?
The probability flux vector, this thing. Sometimes called the probability current. So let's calculate it. J equals h bar over 2im. We're only interested in the radial part pointing in the direction r. So we just have to consider what happens when you look at d by dr. Only the d by dr term is important. So it will be equal to psi star d psi dr minus d of psi star dr times psi. We only are interested in the 1 over r squared piece. So whatever happens, you better not differentiate this, because this will give you something higher order. You differentiate that term, you'll end up with a 1 over r squared, but it's always going to be multiplied by this again. So you really don't want to differentiate that. So as r goes to infinity, this thing is, there's no r dependence in here. The only differential thing that you're interested in is differentiating the thing in the exponent. So you will get e to the minus ikr over r, f star, times d by dr of this thing. There's an ik e to the plus ikr over r, times f. If you differentiated this r, you get an extra power of 1 over r, and this would look like 1 over r cubed, which falls off too fast to be important. Then you get this second term. But the second term is just the same as the first, so you give yourself a factor of 2. The answer is going to be equal to, the i's go, the 2's go, and you get h bar k over m times mod of f squared. Now you can calculate the scattering cross-section. It's just the quotient of these two things. D sigma d omega is the scattered flux divided by the incoming flux. So it's this divided by that, which is just mod of S squared. So that's what you need to calculate to find the scattering cross section. This thing is sometimes called the scattering amplitude because its square modulus is equal to the cross section. On Monday, we will calculate some scattering amplitudes. So let's stop there.
Yeah, okay. So it's a variable. Yeah, okay.